Vamos a pasar a la siguiente audiencia sobre situación de niños indígenas en escuelas de Estados Unidos, que ha sido solicitada por el Boarding School Healing Project, the Western Social Defense Project, the National Congress of American Indians, the Seventh Generation Fund, the International Indian Treaty Council, Cultural Survival, the U.S. Human Rights Network y otras 37 organizaciones. Participarán en esta audiencia las organizaciones solicitantes a través de sus representantes, que les pediré que se identifiquen, así como representantes del gobierno de Estados Unidos. Se trata de una audiencia temática. Si los las peticionarias se refirieran a algún caso específico, la comisión lo considerará a título meramente ilustrativo, de manera que no hay necesidad de levantar temas de agotamiento de recursos internos ni nada por el estilo. Lo digo para evitar malentendidos. Tendrán 20 minutos los peticionarios, 20 minutos el Estado, y luego formularemos preguntas. Me acompañan el comisionado Pablo Sello Piñeiro, quien es primer vicepresidente de la comisión y relator para la niñez de la comisión, la comisionada María Silvia Guillén, el comisionado Rodrigo Escobar Gil y el doctor Federico Guzmán, de la Relatoría de Pueblos Indígenas de la comisión. Tienen la palabra entonces las peticionarias por 20 minutos.
Good morning, esteemed commissioners and distinguished representatives of the U.S. government. We would like to express our profound appreciation to the commission for convening a hearing on this critical issue. My name is Andrea Ritchie. I'm an attorney who works with the Boarding School Healing Project. This morning you will hear from Dr. Andrea Smith, who's an associate professor at University of California, Riverside, and a well-known Native Studies scholar, and also a co-founder of the Boarding School Healing Project. Professor Smith will provide a historical background of the issue and provide a survey of the human rights violations which took place in schools Native children were mandated to attend in the United States. Following Dr. Smith's testimony, Dr. Denise Lajmodier, who is assistant professor at North Dakota State University, will share the results of her extensive research with boarding school survivors between the ages of 40 and 88, as well as her family's own personal experiences with compulsory attendance at these schools and the horrific abuses they experienced therein, as well as the widespread and ongoing effects of these abuses at Native communities. And then, time permitting, I will outline the remedies sought by the project. Thank you, commissioners.
Good afternoon, commissioners and distinguished representatives of the United States. The Boarding School Healing Project was founded in 2002 to document the human rights abuses committed against Native children in American Indian boarding schools, with a particular focus on schools in North and South Dakota. Our work has been done in collaboration with many other organizations concerned about this issue. As a brief history, during the 19th and 20th century, Native children were, as a matter of state policy, mandated to attend government-run or sponsored boarding schools dedicated to the assimilation of American Indian children. In many cases, they were forcibly abducted from their parents to attend these schools, or parents were threatened with the withholding of rations if they didn't send their children to these schools. And this boarding school system became systematized under Grant's peace policy in 1869, and the goal of this policy was to turn over the administration of Indian reservations over to church denominations. And through this policy, funds were set aside for churches to build schools for American Indian children, and even though churches operated these schools, they were done so through state funding and were ostensibly monitored by state officials. The system was extended then in 1879 with the off-reservation boarding school system, in which children were taken away from their homes at, say, the age of five and not returned until they were adults. And the rationale for this policy was stated as, kill the Indian by saving the man. By 1909, there was 25 off-reservation boarding schools, 157 on-reservation schools, and 307 day schools. Although many of these schools eventually closed, their legacy continues, and Native communities continue to suffer the effects of intergenerational abuse, and they also suffer the impact of cultural genocide that was effectuated through boarding school policies. Additionally, these schools still continue. The Bureau of Indian Affairs operates over 152 schools, including 66 boarding schools, in which over 41,000 Native children are enrolled, and there are continuing charges of physical and sexual abuse that are not being addressed by the U.S. government. Unlike other countries that have had similar boarding school systems, such as Canada, the U.S. has conducted no investigation and has provided no restitution to individuals and communities who have suffered extensive violation of their human rights through boarding school policies, nor has it attended to the continuing effect of human rights violations, as other countries have done. So while my colleague Denise will present testimony based on our research, I will just provide some of the overall findings of the human rights violations as well as the continuing effects of these violations. Specific violations of the rights guaranteed by the American Declaration of the Rights of Man that the Boarding School Healing Project has documented include 1. Abuse. Sexual, physical, and emotional abuse was rampant in these schools. Survivors report widespread physical torture. They were often forced to beat other children and witness the torture of other students. Meanwhile, even when there was allegations of abuse, school administrators refused to investigate or address these problems. In addition, there is widespread allegations of sexual abuse, often by multiple perpetrators in boarding schools. For instance, in one school in 1987, the FBI found that one teacher had sexually abused over 142 boys, and yet the principal refused to investigate any of these allegations. And in another case, a teacher actually admitted on his job application that he had been arrested for child sexual abuse and was hired anyway in a boarding school in Arizona. And despite this epidemic of sexual abuse in boarding schools, the U.S. government failed to implement any effective procedures for monitoring teachers within these schools. And the result of this is that Native communities now have epidemic rates of sexual and physical abuse because of these boarding school policies, because these rates did not exist in Native communities prior to colonization. For instance, now Native women suffer the highest levels of domestic and sexual violence compared to any other group in the U.S. And while the current administration has been making progress, particularly with the recent passage of the Tribal Law and Order Act, healing and advocacy programs for Native communities remain gravely underfunded. The next issue, death in schools. Thousands of children died in these schools as a result of beating, medical neglect, and malnutrition. Because of overcrowding, disease often spread rapidly, which resulted in mass numbers of death. For instance, in one school, Haskell Indian School, there were over 102 student graves, and at least 500 students died there and were buried elsewhere. And even as recently as 2004, Cindy So Happy was a student in the Chamawa Boarding School where she died in a holding cell, and she was videotaped dying, and none of the administrators did anything to intervene. And yet the U.S. attorney declined to pursue any charges. The next issue would be religious and cultural suppression. Native children were not allowed to speak their languages or practice their spiritual traditions and were punished severely if they did so. The continuing effect of this abuse is that of the approximately 155 indigenous languages still spoken in the U.S., it is estimated that 90% will be extinct in 10 years, and by 2050, there will only be 20 languages left, and of those, 90% of those will be facing extinction in 50 years. And yet, the U.S. has grossly underfunded language revitalization programs. Malnutrition. Because the state provided inadequate funding to run Indian boarding schools, children received inadequate food. Survivors testified that the best food was saved for school administrators and teachers, with many children dying of malnutrition. And survivors report today that they continue to suffer the effects of these practices through eating disorders with associated diseases such as diabetes. Inadequate medical care. Children were often punished when they even sought medical care, and survivors report that when they went to infirmaries, they were often sexually abused there. A 1976 U.S. General Accounting Office report admitted that Native children in boarding schools were being subjected to medical experimentation programs without the consent of their parents. Survivors of boarding schools experience long-term impacts of lack of proper medical care and often report a reluctance to seek medical attention for now because of the treatment they received then. Forced labor. In addition to being forced to perform labor in order to maintain the schools, children were also involuntarily leased to white people's homes to perform menial labor during the summers rather than being allowed to go back to their homes. They were often forced to work in hazardous conditions, and they were not compensated for their work. And finally, inadequate education. The supposed purpose of these schools was to educate Native children, and yet that was not fulfilled. The survivors reported they received inadequate education and were essentially prepared only to do manual labor. As a result, Native peoples continue to suffer chronic unemployment. So with this outline, I will now turn it over to my colleague who will present testimony from survivors from these schools.
Bonjour, Anine. Habis kabine sawana kwa tashi jakto dem. Mikna kwa ajun en dunjiba. Merci ki peste yek. Chilingwich kakina awya. I thank all of you for allowing us to be here today, for you being here to listen to our testimony. My tribal name is White Thundercloud Woman, and I am of the Crane Clan, and I'm an enrolled citizen of the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe Indians in North Dakota, up along the Canadian border, where there is now a blizzard. My interest in the boarding school healing project is that because of my parents and the horror stories that they have told me, my grandparents and the stories I hear from them, and also their brothers and sisters and many of the elders and the cousins of my family that are survivors of boarding school. So I have interviewed them, and I've also interviewed many other people from the Fort Berthold Reservation and from my own reservation. I'm interwoven my family story with their stories, with their interviews. My father was hidden in the bush until he was found by an Indian agent. He was hidden by the family he was raised with. He spoke no English. None of them did. They would tell him Pimbasta when the agent would come and try to take him away. They finally threatened his parents with taking their commodities away and their wood pile, which in North Dakota, where it gets to 40 below, would have meant death for this elder couple. So he was sent from North Dakota to Chemawa, Oregon, 3 days and three nights on a train, and he wasn't allowed to come home for 4 years. My mother was sent to the Immaculate Conception School for Poor Indian Children in Stefan, South Dakota, from the time she was 5 until she was 17. My grandparents and Native way we call my grandfathers, his brothers and so on, we also call them grandfathers, they were sent to Fort Totten, which is where an old military fort where Custer had his 7th Cavalry at one time. 4 years was usually the minimum that was encouraged for these students to be sent to the boarding schools. The parents often had no contact with their children because the kids were sent so far away and the parents were too poor to be able to visit them. Students were usually kept at school holidays and summers. Because of General Pratt and his military background, the schools were organized on a military discipline. The survivors talk of marching everywhere they went. They woke to bells, whistles, often dozens a day. My father was at boarding school when he was in 1925, and he said they woke to bugles all the time. And he was also made to forced to march with a wooden gun everywhere they went, to and from anything, from church or to the cafeteria, with a little wooden gun when he was tiny, and then they had metal guns when they were older. And he said they couldn't even move their eyes side to side or they would get beaten. One survivor said, working, 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 we were always working. Because the government underfunded the schools, the children were forced to do all of the work for the schools. They worked in the kitchen, the laundry room, the farm. They built the buildings. The school was scheduled on half a day of school and half day of mandatory forced labor. That's how they supported the schools. The average schedule was the kids were up around 5:30. Their beds were made so a quarter could bounce on them. They had to clean the rooms, wash up. They did other duties, church, breakfast, and then school, their half day of school. Very young girls were made to work with dangerous mangles in the laundry room, and they said they were often injured with the mangles, and they were sickened by the constant heat and the steam, and the same thing with the work they had to do in the kitchens three times a day. Girls had to sew all of the school uniforms, darn socks, they did the ironing. They were encouraged to only become wives and homemakers. There was no other choice. The students said they rotated monthly from the kitchen to the laundry preparing meals, and the boys, both boys and girls, worked in fields and gardens. My dad said he worked in the onion fields and also picking berries. These fruits and berries didn't make it to the table. they were sold to help support the school. The boys worked at learning vocations such as carpentry and tinsmithing, which my father learned, and things such as shoemaking and blacksmithing. And often these jobs, there was no such job for these kids when they did return to the reservation. They scrubbed their floors on hands and knees, and toothbrushes if punished. Because of the half-day program, concentrations on vocations, survivors said when they did go back to the reservation, they were behind academically, and many of them dropped out of school. Pratt had something called an outing program to keep the students there at the boarding school, and that's where he sent the students out to white families in surrounding towns and farms, where they were used, as one person said, an indentured slave servant. And they told me of being sexually molested and beaten at these homes. One 74-year-old survivor said she was worked to death for 25 cents an hour. In the dorms, the students said they cried themselves to sleep every night, no matter how long that they were there, or they'd hear others crying themselves to sleep at night. My father told a story of in his dorm, the beds were very close together, and they had to sleep two boys to a bed, and that students would wake up and find another boy died during the night. And I asked what happened. He said they refused to eat, and they would just die of loneliness. Now I think that's called failure to thrive. The survivors, the people I interviewed, told of nuns and priests putting pins through their tongues if they were caught speaking a tribal language. My dad told about, he didn't speak any English at all, neither did my mom when they went to school. And they had lye soap put in their mouths until the inside of their mouth blistered from the soap. Sometimes the headmaster, the teacher, or the nuns would make them blow bubbles to make sure that they had the soap in their mouth. Older students were encouraged to be snitches and told on the younger ones. Students were beaten on bare buttocks until sticks were broken. Other students were made to watch a student being disciplined, adding to the humiliation. Boys and girls were absolutely separated in these boarding schools. My father's sister went with him to the boarding school, and he very seldom saw her. There was literally a white line that was drawn where they could stand and sometimes visit. Razor straps with studs were used to beat bare backs was a common discipline, according to the research in almost all of the schools. My father said he was told on. He had made the comment that this man and this woman had a case for each other, that they liked each other, and he was told on. He was made to lay across the bed with his hands held by students and his feet held by students, and the students behind him, the little boys, had to line up, and they had to each take their turn hitting him with that belt with studs in it. And if anybody let up and hit gentlier, because that was, you know, he was their friend, they would have had to take his place. He ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks, laying on his stomach, or in the infirmary, and he said he almost died, and he still has the scars when he died, when he was 77 years old, so the physical scars, and I know the emotional scars. He said they killed a boy from Blackfeet. They ruptured his kidneys when they did the gauntlet. The gauntlet was popular up until the 1960s, and I wonder now if my father wasn't one of the boys in line that had to hit that little Blackfeet boy and maybe felt that he killed him. And because my dad worked in the carpentry, did he have to build a coffin also for that boy? And there is a cemetery at Chamala. I went there. There's a lot of unmarked graves there. And there was a lot of boys that died in the years, or a lot of children in the years that my father was there. My mom was forced to kneel on broomstick handles with her nose pressed against the wall. That was fairly common. Palms of hands were hit with a belt until blistered, fingers and knuckles broken. Bedwetting was a big issue. A matron shoved the girls' faces in a pan of urine for wetting the bed. A six-year-old girl was thrown in a cellar and left there for 3 days. The nuns didn't find her until she was almost dead. Students saw fellow students commit suicide by hanging in the bathroom, throwing themselves on railroad tracks at Chamala, drowning while trying to escape. A five-year-old told me of being molested by a priest for many years. He'd take her in there, and she believed he gave her wine, and he would even take her to the doctor to check her private parts. She put herself into a psychiatric ward for 5 weeks. She never told the doctors about the sexual abuse. She was ashamed. She said, "What will they think of me? They'll just think because I'm Indian that I should have stopped it." Heads were soaked in kerosene, dusted in DDT powder. All hair was cut off. Braids were cut off. The students were given a number. My auntie's number, she's 89. She says, my number was 76. And that was put on all of her clothes. Traditions, language was strictly forbidden. Most of us don't speak our language. My family doesn't speak because my parents said, we don't want you kids to go through the hell we went through. Crowded dorm rooms, there was horrible trachoma, horrid impetigo that was just left with running sores. A young boy had a broken arm, was made to carry a bucket of sand. Flu, scarlet, TB was rampant. A nun threw hot oatmeal at a student, and she still had the burns she showed me. Kids were hungry. They stole food. My grandfather stole a can of tomatoes because he was hungry. They laid him over a barrel, and they hit him with a hose until he passed out. One survivor said the students all had to go to a dentist in a nearby town, and everyone had their teeth filled whether they needed it or not. One student said he never had problems with his ears, but he was taken to a doctor, and they did something to him, and now he's had trouble ever since. When the kids returned home, because they were sent for so long, they didn't know their families. One little girl said, Mother Superior said, there's your mother over there, and she said, no, you're my mother, Mother Superior. So one of the other issues is that, where did my parents learn how to be parents? They never had parents. They were taken away from their parents. My father went on to become a violent alcoholic, and he was beaten with a strap, and us kids were beaten with a strap, and my brother was beaten almost every day. We weren't able to learn our language. My mom was locked in the closet. Kids that were locked in the closet would pee and defecate on themselves, and they'd get beaten for that, but the nuns and headmasters wouldn't let them out of the closet. This is called, we're relating, Native historians are relating this, the issues that have happened to us now, the same as they are with Holocaust survivors, the children of Holocaust survivors, and Japanese internment camps, and we're calling it generational trauma, multi-generational trauma, historical trauma, and unresolved grieving. I know there's unresolved grieving in my family. I've been through a lot of personal therapy and so on to try to deal with what has happened to my parents and grandparents. The lady that went into the psychiatric hospital and still never told what happened to her. How many of our people are still in that mold? Most of the people I've interviewed have said they've never told their children and grandchildren, and that they never will. They said, we have to think of the horror of what we went through every day. I will not do that to my children and grandchildren. But they've kept that grief and that horror and that pain inside, especially the sexual abuse. This collective trauma has been characterized as a soul wound of our people. It's been present in Indian country for many generations. Guilt, anxiety, grief, depressive symptomology. Emerging work suggests that impacts may have included family issues with family communication. Okay, that's our 20 minutes. Chiminguich, thank you.
Muchas gracias a las peticionarias. De todas maneras, tendrán la palabra nuevamente por si quisieran agregar otros aspectos. Tiene la palabra entonces la representación del Estado por 20 minutos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, let me underscore here our commitment to support and engage seriously in these discussions, especially in a session which is obviously of high importance to the United States, considering the historical nature of this particular discussion and on the situation of Native American children in schools. I'd like to begin by introducing my colleagues from the U.S. government who will be participating this morning, Charles Trumbull from the Office of the Legal Advisor of the State Department, Eric Bruce Wilson, the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, the Department of Interior. I'd also like to introduce Sakia Carr Johnson of the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs of the State Department, and colleagues from the U.S. Mission to the Organization of the American States, Andrea Briette Rodriguez, Dan Cento, Andrew Stevenson, and Chaz Holm. I'd like to draw on some comments made by Ambassador Rice, our U.S. representative to the United Nations, in her statement on indigenous issues, in which she noted that in his presidential proclamation honoring Native American Heritage Month, President Obama recognized that the indigenous peoples of North America, the first American, have woven rich and diverse threads into the tapestry of our nation's heritage. What is true in the Americas is true around this hemisphere. There's no true history that does not take into account the story of indigenous populations, their proud traditions, their rich cultures, and their contributions to our shared heritage and identity. And that's true throughout this hemisphere. President Obama is deeply committed to strengthening and building on government-to-government relationships among the United States and our tribal governments. Our administration has moved quickly to launch programs to improve the lives of Native Americans. Shortly after his inauguration, the president appointed Kimberly Teehee as his Native American policy advisor and began extensive outreach to tribal leaders. In November of last year, President Obama invited representatives from each of our Indian tribes in the United States to attend a White House Tribal Nations Conference. Nearly 500 tribal leaders participated, the most widely attended White House tribal meeting with President, Cabinet Secretaries, senior officials, and members of Congress in U.S. history. On November 5th, the President directed every federal agency to implement fully the executive order on consultation and coordination with tribal governments, which mandates all agencies have an accountable process for meaningful and timely input by tribal officials in the development of regulatory policies that have tribal implications. The level of consultation with the tribes is now at historic levels, marking a new era in the U.S. relationship with tribal governments. In March 2010, President Obama signed a reform of the U.S. healthcare system that reduces the healthcare disparities that Native Americans still face. Signing and implementing this landmark law constitutes a major step toward fulfilling our national responsibility to provide high-quality, affordable health care to all citizens, including American Indians and Alaska Natives. Last year, in the face of the global economic crisis, President Obama took swift action to spur economic activity. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act was part of that, and it specifically allocates more than $3 billion to assist tribal communities. These funds are being used to renovate schools on reservations across the country, to create new jobs in tribal economies, improve housing, support healthcare facilities. The President's fiscal year 2011 budget also proposes a 5% increase in federal funding for Native American programs, to a total of $18.5 billion. Consistent with President Obama's call for a new era of U.S. engagement with the world, the United States applauds the Commission's efforts to raise awareness of issues affecting our region's indigenous people and to generate ideas for substantially improving their livelihoods and communities. Today, I am pleased to inform the Commission, in the context of today's hearing, the United States has decided to review our position regarding the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We recognize that for many around the world, this declaration provides a framework for addressing indigenous issues. During President Obama's first year in office, tribal leaders encouraged the U.S. to re-examine its position on this declaration, an important recommendation that directly complements our commitment to work together with the international community on the many challenges that indigenous peoples face. We are now conducting a formal review of the declaration and the U.S. position on it, and as we move ahead, we look forward to consulting extensively with valued and experienced colleagues in the federally recognized Indian tribes and interested non-governmental organizations. While many steps have been taken, we seek to continue to work together with our partners in indigenous communities to provide security, prosperity, equality, and opportunity for all. There's no American history without Native American history. There can be no just and decent future for our nation that does not directly tackle the legacy of bitter discrimination and sorrow that first Americans still live with. And America cannot be fully whole until its first inhabitants enjoy all the blessings of liberty, prosperity, and dignity. There should be no doubt about our commitment. Today, in the context of that commitment to our Native American citizens, we pledge to undertake a serious review of the information placed before us by the petitioners and provide a response to the Commission in turn. In this manner, we plan to continue this dialogue on an issue of such a sensitive nature. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like now to introduce Bruce Wilson from the Department of Interior's Office of Indian Affairs.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in 2000, the Department of the Interior recognized the historic wrongs committed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and apologized for these practices. And the department remains deeply concerned about these past policies and their effects on subsequent generations. For this reason, we have carefully read the letter submitted by the petitioners and welcome the opportunity to listen to the claims presented today. We will report these claims back to our department and will respond in writing after careful consideration and discussions among relevant agencies. Thank you.
Agradezco la presentación del gobierno y le ofrezco la palabra a mis colegas, el comisionado Escobar Gil.
Sí, a mí un punto que me preocupa y que quisiera preguntarle al Estado es que no escuché ningún pronunciamiento al tema concreto de esta audiencia, que es la situación de niños indígenas en escuelas de Estados Unidos. Quisiera preguntar si en la actualidad existe una política pública en materia de educación para asegurar que los niños de las comunidades indígenas sean educados con programas acordes a su cosmovisión, a sus valores, a su cultura, a sus usos y costumbres, para efectos de preservar su identidad cultural. Si existen escuelas en donde los docentes pertenezcan a las comunidades indígenas y hablen sus propias lenguas.
Comisionado Piñeiro, que es relator para la Reñez.
Thank you, Mr. President. We acknowledge and we commend the government of the United States for this review of the United Nations Declarations of Indigenous Rights. I think that is a very important step. We have followed also the statements by Ambassador Rice and all the statements by President Obama, and we have to rejoice with this. There is no doubt at all. And it's a dramatic and decisive change. It's not just a formality, what I'm saying. We just recognize how many years this took to happen. But I think that the issue that we are discussing in this thematic hearing has a specificity that are not only the indigenous peoples, but are the children of the indigenous peoples. As you know, the United States is the only state in the region that has not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child that the Commission and the Inter-American Court recognize as an element of the corpus juris of the Inter-American system. I need to acknowledge also that despite this non-ratification of the Convention, in the United States prevail an enormous number of good practices and that really protects the rights of the child. But we hope also that President Obama will be able to review also the position of the United States government concerning this convention. We have great hopes concerning this convention. Entonces, considerando essa especificidade, o que queria perguntar ao Estado é justamente se seria possível uma manifestação em termos, escutei de los peticionários que não havia um estudo, uma investigação mais profunda sobre esses fatos por parte dello Estados Unidos. Entonces, y también me gustaría preguntar al Estado si en el cuerpo de esa review esa decisión ha iluminado alguna acción concreta en relación a esos hechos específicos. Quería también decir que la comisión está a la disposición del gobierno de Estados Unidos y los peticionarios para trabajarmos juntos en esa dirección. Quería terminar diciendo que cuando preparé para el secretario general de Naciones Unidas el informe mundial sobre violencia contra niñez con la colaboración de Estados Unidos, justamente esa práctica fue reconocida como una expresión de violencia contra niñez. Y por eso necesitaría una respuesta muy objetiva, específica, sobre no solamente sobre el legado, pero la extensión de esa práctica en el presente. Muchas gracias.
Petitioners have the floor for 7 minutes now.
Thank you, commissioners, for your questions of the government. We certainly share your enthusiasm for the U.S. government's decision to review its position on the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as well as your concern that there has, in the state's response, been no concrete remedies offered consistent with Articles 18 and 24 of the American Declaration with respect to the harms that we are talking about, both past and continuing. As the Commissioner just said, the legacy and the extent to which they're still happening. Accordingly, the petitioners are respectfully requesting that the Commission recommend that the U.S. government immediately develop and put in place, consistent with Articles 18 and 24, public, simple, effective, and timely administrative procedures enabling individual survivors of Indian residential schools to petition for redress. Additionally, consistent with the comment that there has been no fact-finding inquiry to date, that the state convene a congressional inquiry aimed at acknowledging and documenting and addressing the full range of human rights violations endured by Native children. As indicated, while an apology is often welcome, the UN Guidelines for Reparations set forth in 2005 set forward 5 principles for reparations for the kinds of collective harms that we're talking about, and those include restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition. So there's still quite a bit of work to be done on this front. And then we would like to take the Commission up on its offer to work with both parties here on this issue, and respectfully ask that the Commission avail itself of its authority to request permission from the U.S. government to conduct a site visit so that you may visit Native communities across the United States and see for yourselves firsthand and begin this process of documentation firsthand the devastating ongoing effects of over a century of human rights violations against Native children in state-run facilities.
And we would also like to acknowledge the great work that the Obama administration has done in promoting good relationships with Native communities. In this particular case, though, we have models of other countries in similar situations, particularly Canada, that we can follow. You know, that there was this extensive government investigation at the Royal Commission, and there's a national reconciliation, truth and reconciliation program. So we have models that the U.S. can follow. So it is our hope that the U.S. will follow this and do its own models of restitution, reparation, and reconciliation so that survivors here can have their voices be heard.
I know that my story is only one of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Native people. When 75% of our people were in boarding schools by the 1930s, even that, it's the repercussions still affect those of us that were not sent to boarding schools. So it affects almost every Native person in the United States right now. I have some friends that they did a walk from Chamawa to to Carlisle. They went across the United States to all of the, to many of the boarding schools, not all of them, and they have videotaped recordings of survivors, and they are going to turn those over to us so that we can transcribe them and have their stories told. I believe every Native boarding school survivor needs to tell their story, much as Holocaust people have, or the Japanese internment people have told their stories. We need to hear more of their stories. Many of the people I interviewed, they said, "We've never told anybody. I don't know why I'm telling you." And I said, "I know why. I asked. Otherwise, my 89-year-old uncle and auntie would never have told the horrors of what they went through. My uncle has had too many heart attacks, and he started getting so angry with what I now call unresolved grief that I stopped the interview and I won't talk to him anymore. I don't know what happened to him, but it was so horrifying that he's still angry." So wherever you go, if you choose to come to the reservations, you're going to hear these stories, because it's affected and is still affecting all Native peoples here in the United States. Chiminguich.
Thank you very much. The government has the floor for 7 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the questions about schools, I don't have a great deal of detail with me right now, but I do note that much of the funding that was provided under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act was used for schools. And now we're talking about schools in a modern context in which the rights of the indigenous, and in this case of the American Indians, are respected. So I think that while that doesn't cover some of the things we've just heard, at least going forward, we're not committing the same grievous tragedies in the future. With respect to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, I'm afraid I'm not in a position to offer you any change or improvement there. We don't know, at least the people here don't know, of studies that have been done on the schools, and perhaps some of our compatriots can inform us better after on some things that we might consider. Certainly any proposals for further investigations would be received and studied carefully and addressed. So while I'm not in a position to make commitments, I think we're obviously open to suggestions and to the Commission's views and the views of the petitioners. Thank you.
Before ending the hearing, I would like to point out that for the Commission, generally speaking, official investigations are of a very different nature than our kind of investigations. So in that respect, the fact that the state itself can do that kind of investigation would be very important. I would also ask the U.S. delegation to keep the Commission informed about the response that the representative from the Ministry of Interior said at the end of his presentation before, that would be sent to the petitioners. So the Commission can do a follow-up on this issue. Thank you very much.